Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, this is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. I'm Bruce Daisley. It's a podcast about making work better. Thank you for listening. This week, I've launched a mailing list, largely because there was so much left over from my book that I'm going to be giving it out on the mailing list for free. So if you're interested, you could sign up for that at eatsleepworkrepeat.fm. There's going to be extra chapters, things you can try with teams, a selection of the articles that are shaping the world of culture and more. Currently, I've been sort of sharing these things on Twitter, and you can find that by searching Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. But now the newsletter will provide the same in your inbox. Now, stuff I shared this week on Twitter, I've shared a lot about sync. Sync is this remarkable phenomenon which you observe in a lot of the papers on workplace interactions. And it's sort of like the dark matter of workplace culture, really. I'll give you one example. Researchers put a group of rowers together and then got them to each row as hard as they could. Then they got another group of rowers together and they got those rowers to row in a sort of simulated boat. So where they needed to be in sync with each other for the boat to go. Here's a remarkable thing. They then tested the sort of the pain tolerance, the pain sufferance of these rowers. And the rowers who rowed in sync could withstand double the pain of the other rowers. It's an illustration of how scientists observe the same phenomenon in different places. So you see it in choirs where groups of people sing together. You see it with people who dance together. So the question, of course, becomes how can your average workplace access this? Well, the anthropologist Robin Dunbar says a lot of this sync can be sort of recreated by laughing with others. Anyway, I love this stuff. You'll see some of that on the newsletter. So if you're interested, sign up on the website. Or I guess go to Twitter in the meantime. The only other plug I'll add is that this science makes up about a third of my new book, The Joy of Work. I'm going to add some dates to the website where you can come and see me around the launch of the book in January. But if you want to understand the science of sync, you can pre-order it. And it's worth flagging, American listeners can order from UK Amazon, but the book will be coming to the US next. Now, we're talking work culture in different ways for the next few episodes. The next two episodes after this are from the police force, but today's guest is the best-selling author of the year, Adam Kay. His book, This Is Going to Hurt, Secret Diaries of a Junior Doctor, has sold over 1 million copies. It's also won the Reader's Choice Book of the Year Award. So look, you know, there's a chance you've read it. And if you have read it, I think you'll love the discussion with Adam Kay, because he takes us into the working environment, hospitals, and he sort of gives us an insight of his feeling that maybe didn't get captured in the book. If you've not read it, I could not recommend anything more than this beautiful, funny, principle book. In This Is Going to Hurt, Adam explains that the title Junior Doctor is a touch misleading. Effectively, anyone who isn't a consultant is titled Junior Doctor. As Adam describes, he's now a successful comedy writer, and he left the health service after probably one of the worst days at work that any of us could ever suffer. But actually, his motivation to write it after sort of a long period after leaving the job was largely because he observed underpaid, overworked health workers being politicised by the sort of the vampires who run modern day government. Specifically, the multimillionaire former health secretary, Jeremy Hunt, who claimed in some way that doctors were greedy. The book's the funniest thing you're going to read this year, but I think you'll find the discussion that we have thoughtful and really gives you a clear insight into the working culture of hospitals. US listeners will know that the issue of single-payer healthcare is a hot topic in the US, where single-payer, of course, is the government. In the UK, we've got the NHS, and it's worth saying, as Adam says here, it's a source of national pride. We just need to fund it properly. So I hope you'll enjoy this as much as I did. I joined Adam for a chat at a restaurant in West London. Thank you so much for talking to me. I think you... The reason why I find this so heartening and so sort of life-affirming is that you've written this book that's fantastically funny, but also hidden within the humour, there's a lot of really serious points. Did you expect it to be such a success?
I didn't expect it to be any kind of success, but I'm delighted it has been, mostly because I wrote the book not to be funny, even though, I mean, the book's obviously a confidence trick. It's, you know, it gets read because it's notionally funny. But I wrote it to spread the message that's the subtext about the fact that it's a difficult job being a doctor. And the more people read it, the more people, next time doctors come under fire, will know my side of the story, the doctor's side of the story.
It sort of struck me a bit. I remember seeing Jamie Oliver talk about meat and saying that British people have got this natural aversion to seeing meat in its sort of unchopped up form, and so consequently we put loads of rubbish in it, and you know, we sort of hide away from the unspeakable truths. And it just really struck me that by scratching below the surface of the NHS, that you see a lot of things that the NHS would rather you not see. The very fact, firstly, that people are in a state of sleep deprivation, exhaustion and overwork.
I don't think the NHS has ever tried to hide the fact that doctors work as hard as they do. It's that previously, doctors have never had a reason to stand up and say, we really do sacrifice a lot for this job. So the catalyst for the book basically was a couple of years ago when the junior doctors, you remember, were coming under fire from the government. And the government were putting out this message that doctors are striking because they're being greedy, because they're being lazy, because they wanted more money. And the truth was, it was about working conditions and the patient's best interest. And the government had such a loud voice and the doctors had such a quiet voice. The government won. And I thought if more people knew quite how bad the hours are, the fact that you might work 97 hours in a week, the fact that doctors routinely, you know, cancel their own stag do's and 30th birthday parties to make the job work, the fact that of the 7 Christmases that I was qualified as a doctor, I managed to see my family for one of them, so it wasn't all bad, and the fact that you move hospital once a year, frequently hundreds of miles apart. That was the sort of stuff that I wanted people to know about, because we all realise that doctors work hard, but I thought people might not realise. We don't know what it's like generally. We've got an idea about what someone's job involves, but probably don't know the minutiae of it.
But you say that the NHS doesn't try and mislead, but there's the diary card episode or exercise where there's a sort of stock take, this equivalent of someone coming in to check the amount of hours that everyone's working, and there's definitely some misdirection that goes on there.
There is, which is internal rather than misdirection. The idea of this is that the hospital gets fined if they're working their doctors too hard, and then once a year or so, yeah, they do this stock take where every doctor has to fill in their hours, all the junior doctors, by everyone who isn't a consultant. And mysteriously, on those days, the wards are flooded with consultants who've never previously been seen once on these wards, you know, making sure that everyone gets away on time. So, yeah, there is jiggery pokery and tricksiness within hospitals. I don't think the NHS has ever, you know, broadcast itself to be anything other than it is to the public.
I remember reading something recently, which was a study of people who worked in investment banking, and it was by an investment banker who'd turned a psychologist, and she was looking at 120 hours a week and the impact that was having on people, whether it was, you know, hair loss, skin problems, depression, anxiety, in one case cancer that she attributed to it. And I read through this and I thought, wow, it's exactly the same hours and the demands upon people. I mean, the way you describe the situation where a pager constantly bleeping, it reminded me of working in a fast food restaurant. Like, you know, just constant demands upon you.
Yeah, it's full on. It really, really is full on. And it isn't good for you. It isn't good for you. Shift work of any form has an impact on your life and your life expectancy. And it means you're often a bit of a shell when you're outside of work. I think one of the main things I wanted to get across was the idea as the doctor as a human being. Because when you go and see a doctor, you don't want to think of them as too human because they're interpreting the MRI of your shoulder. They need to be 100% correct. But no, humans get things wrong, and humans get sad, and humans get sick. I did an antenatal clinic, so for pregnant mums, for a year. And there's the traditional mismatch of doctors and patients in the clinic. So the clinic overran by 3 hours every week. And every week, patients rightly would complain, you know, this is ridiculous, I've been waiting 3 hours, I've got problems with the car parking and the childcare, and I would apologise, and fair enough. But not once in a year of doing this did a single patient say, oh, you probably don't want to be here either at 8 o'clock when your contract said you finish at 5. But it's just part of the job. You know, the NHS is kept going by people going beyond the call of duty. And previously, doctors, nurses haven't shouted about this because previously no one in government has said, the doctors are being greedy, the doctors are being lazy. But as soon as that happens, that made me want to do my bit to help.
Right. So it was effectively the politicisation of doctors against their will by politicians, by them using you as effectively hostages, that sort of provoked you. Because you also talk about how these sort of like a gingerbread house of private healthcare, that we're led down a little trail of crumbs. And it's all painted as quite benign, the movement towards sort of privatisation. And the reason why, so back to what I opened with, the reason why I find this book so inspiring is because you make that point really clearly, that this is a dangerous path and we're going to concede something that we love dearly.
It is. I think there isn't going to be a big announcement in the Times one day which says, the NHS is over, there's a new private insurance-based system. It's going to be very stealthy, little corners here and there. Every time there's a new contract in an area given out to a private company, it's going to happen very, very slowly. And it's going to be bad for the people who have the quietest voice. And those are the people who have the least. So the NHS, I think, is our greatest achievement as a civilization. It's free at the point of service, and it's based on clinical needs, not bank balance. As soon as it becomes something else, as soon as it becomes two-tier in any way, as soon as there's an insurance component, you'll be fine. I'll be fine. Most of the people who listen will be fine. But it's the people who have the least who won't be. They're the people who always suffer in this kind of system, and they're the people who have the quietest voice. I mean, quite often you'll see, you know, below the line in a, you know, on a newspaper article online, or in the comment in the letters pages of a physical newspaper, someone will say things like, you should just charge people £5 to see a GP, or £5 to go to any. That will stop all the, you know, that'll solve the. And the people who write this, £5 is just, you know, the difference between a more expensive PrEP and a less expensive PrEP. For the people who are going to suffer, £5 is the difference between feeding their children at all or not. £5 is unimaginable riches, and we don't think of it like that. But for the people who will suffer if the NHS changes, goes away, are those people. And we need to have a big grown-up conversation as a country about what we want, really. I mean, if we want an NHS which is free at the point of service for everyone, based on clinical need, not bank balance, then we're going to have to pay a bit more money, because at the moment there isn't enough money. Or if we think, no, actually, we're paying enough as it is, let's explore another model. And I hope we don't decide that. We need to be honest, and we need to have to the chat.
And I think the reason why this book is such a gift and like sitting at the top of the bestsellers is because it forces that debate that unfortunately we're not really having, are we? You know, certainly there isn't enough of a political debate about it. It's principally, you know, if you do Google trends for how much the different search terms appeared, then winter crisis in the NHS probably appears every year. But it's only those political crises that we get through every Christmas about the NHS Christmas crisis.
Yeah, well, yeah, we need to shine more of a light. And the NHS is stretched more than it's ever been. There's a crisis in recruitment, there's a crisis in retention. And I left medicine in 2010. I don't think you could read my book and think, oh, it was a particularly relaxing job. Now, frequently, doctors are carrying two bleeps, three bleeps. They're working on wards that are 50% staffed, or even worse. Their jobs are more difficult than they've ever been. And that's an untenable situation. It's sort of a system that's already stretched thin, in my day, is now stretched atom thin. And it doesn't take much of an inverted commas winter crisis to break the system.
Yeah, you talk through the approach that you took, because obviously your book's very, very funny, and I'll never look at pram wheels in the same way again. And there's a lot of humour. But you mentioned, I was just interested in how much humour there exists in hospitals.
Very funny things happen. In general, you have to develop your poker face. I use the funny stuff to my advantage, because we don't talk about as doctors the bad stuff that happens. You're not trained in how to cope. You're not trained in resilience. You have to find your own way. For a lot of doctors, it's drink. Some doctors, it's drugs. A lot of doctors don't have a way of coping, leave the profession. A tragic number don't have a way of coping and take their own lives, and we never talk about that. And for me, my coping mechanism was looking for the humour in the situation. And that's why these diaries sort of started. And I didn't quite know at the time. In retrospect, they were quite clearly therapy. They are very funny places, but they're also very sad places. And I wanted this book to be a fair reflection. I wanted a junior doctor to be able to give this book to a friend or family member and say, this is what it's like, this is what my job is. And that meant balancing all of these different aspects. But there is a lot of humour in medicine. You don't want your doctor to be Patch Adams cracking jokes, but nor do you want them to be robotic. There's a bedside manner is something that you cultivate, and there's a degree of acting. You have to disguise your emotions.
Yes, the consequence of that acting, you talked there a little bit about suicide. You describe a scene at one stage where I think, is it a colleague that comes in? Or there's someone that's known to people,
exactly,
comes in
colleague.
On a suicide attempt.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're just reminded there. I guess, for me, I couldn't necessarily attribute that to the job, but just that people live already mentally challenging lives.
It will never be as... Something as complicated as suicide will never be something as simple as it is the job. However, there is a disproportionately high rate of suicide amongst junior doctors, particularly female junior doctors. I had an email nearly 2 months ago from a junior doctor, because it's very easy to get in touch with an author these days. My email's on my website, people get in touch all the time, but one junior doctor said, since he'd started as a doctor 2 years previously, two colleagues had committed suicide. Right. And he could see himself being the third, right, if he didn't do something about it. And I've had a lot of messages from doctors in distress, and I now know the places that they should contact. There is no... If you're a healthcare professional, there's no Samaritan's number. There's no NHS-funded number that you can phone to seek help. There are sort of a few little charities here and there that, you know, this one's only for if you're a GP and only if you're in London, and this one's... The support network isn't there. I just did a week at the Garrick Theatre, reading my diaries on stage, and in my dressing room there's a notice board, and on it said, Theatre Helpline, 24/7, confidential, you know, free, if you're worried about finances, if you're worried about this or that or the other, phone us, we're qualified, we'll speak to you, we'll refer you to counselling. There was no such thing if you're in the medical profession.
Right.
Because it's the culture of we're a bloody doctor and a bloody get on with it and stiff up lip and a stiff drink.
Because you mentioned that specifically, that there's one baby when I think you deal with a premature baby initially and you go in and check on it every day and people find that odd, or you go to one charming woman's funeral.
Yeah.
And you're told very explicitly that you're not to go to this funeral.
Doctors don't do it.
Yes, it's
almost
failed. It's like very old-fashioned English rather than British, and it's like stiff upper lip, very English in the
absolutely,
way we approach it.
Absolutely. It's this... Here's the thing. When I started medical school at Imperial College in London, it was the first year that the topic of communication skills was on the syllabus. Which feels very strange now that you think that's a cornerstone of medical education. And it absolutely is now. But it had to start for the first year, and I was in that first year. And I remember really vividly being in a hospital ward round with a consultant surgeon going around seeing patients and saying, I'm really sorry, I'm going to have to leave and I've got my communication skills lecture. And this surgeon said, you can't teach communication skills, you've either got it or you don't. Because that's what the approach is. And you don't talk about your feelings and you don't talk about the bad stuff. That's why I found this pressure release valve of the diaries. I get emails at least once a week. I'll have an email from a doctor that says, I've never told anyone this, but. So, I mean, my book, I'm not ruining any surprise, because it's, I say this in the first page of the book, that I left medicine because of a very bad day at work. And it's rare for doctors to talk about the kind of thing. And so, I've never told anyone this, but. And then some often retired consultant will tell me this tragedy that's been haunting them, that they've never told their spouse about, they've never told their friends about, they've never told their kids about. My own reason I left medicine, which was horrendous. I worked in obstetrics and gynaecology. I was the most senior doctor at the time on a labour ward. All you ever want is a healthy mum and a healthy baby. And this was a situation where I ended up with neither, awfully. And I realised that I wasn't cut out for it, I wasn't made of the right stuff. And it feels mad because it's been printed out so many times in books, and you know I go around the country talking about it. But at the time, I didn't tell my parents. They knew that I'd left medicine. They didn't know why I'd left medicine, because...
Did you tell your partner? Because this was what I was so interested in.
No,
because I spoke to a fireman who said, if my wife... He described some haunting scene that he had to deal with after a train went through a level crossing. And then I said, oh, okay, did you talk? And he described how they used humour, actually, which I suspect was a long way from what you felt. But I said, did you describe it to your partner? He said, if I described this to my partner, dealing with her horror would make... Would me have to focus on her? So you didn't describe it to your partner. You didn't describe it to your parents.
So I mean, I was in a relationship through medicine, which didn't last for reasons much more complicated than just the job. But you know, the job will always be part of it. But I'm in a new relationship now. It's fairly proper. We're married. We're going out 8 years. You know, but the first time that he heard about this most impactful day of my life was 6 years after it happened, when I got up on stage for the first time and read out from my diaries. And you're not meant to talk about it. And that fireman you spoke to, his attitude is ingrained, and it's pathological, because we should be talking to people about it. There's lots of evidence about how to cope. There's evidence for taking time out, which I wasn't offered. There's evidence for counselling. There's evidence for talking to people who aren't trained at all, just to get off your chest. There's evidence for mindfulness. There's evidence for religion, if that's your bag. There's even evidence for tea. But we ignore all that and we just sort of get on with it.
How did you make the transition from... So I recognise that you left this career that you probably felt burnt out and destroyed by. How did you make the transition to comedy writing?
It wasn't an active decision. It was more the fact that I had to leave medicine and also had to pay the gas bill.
Right.
And I trained for 6 years as a doctor straight out of school, and then I'd done 6 or 7 years on the wards. I was trying to work out, what is my skill set? What else do I have? And the only thing that I had, I thought, I think I was right, was my humour. And at medical school, I'd done a bit of performing and stuff like that, which obviously fizzled away, when I left. I mean, that's the only thing they teach you at medical school, yeah, about how to cope. They don't say that's what it is, but, you know, doing these silly Christmas reviews, making fun of, okay, you know, that's an old-fashioned part of medical school. And that's the, you know, the gallows humour is probably the,
right,
the reason. So that was, I had to grapple around for something to do, and I thought, right, I'm going to give comedy a go, and I'll give it 6 months. If it's not working, then it's not working. What I hadn't realised is that performing comedy is basically a driving job rather than a performing comedy job.
Right.
So, you know, you'll have a performance in Durham. So you drive 1,000 hours to Durham, you're on stage for 20 minutes, then you drive back, right, home because the money isn't enough to pay for a hotel. And so it was a lot of driving.
It's like Deliveroo, where you're also delivering,
yes,
the products.
Yeah, exactly that. And also, it's only in the evenings, and it's mostly Fridays, Saturdays.
Yeah.
And I was sort of, wasn't doing much else, and so I ended up exploring comedy writing for television, which felt like a sort of a natural transition, and I got very lucky, and I've been very lucky since, and people have been kind enough to recommend me when they've worked with me, and I've been busy, and I thought until the book happened, you know, that was my full-time thing. I wrote comedy for,
yeah,
totally.
It's just an incredible coming together, because there was a moment when I was reading the there's a moment where you have to take a sample from an unfortunate baby, and it's incredibly beautiful. It's an incredibly moving and beautiful scene. And it's through this book that's a combination of humour and, you know, celebrating the ridiculous things that people can put up their orifices. And when it transitions into moments that are so powerful and so moving, as a package, it means that your experience of both being a doctor and as a comedian combines to make something that's incredibly powerful, I think.
Oh, that's kind. But it is just the truth of the job. You can be in a clinic, antenatal clinic, and then something happens which is so funny, you know you're going to be telling that story at the pub for 2 years, solidly. And then the next patient, absent heartbeat on the baby. Yeah, that's the worst moment in that family's life. It's just the nature of the job. And I suspect you're right, the fact that the book is predominantly funny means that there's more impact,
yeah,
for the moments that weren't. And in fact, obviously what's in the book is just a selection of stuff I wrote. Obviously lots of stuff ended up being missed out for, whether, you know, because I wanted the balance to be right, of the funny versus the sad versus, lots of stuff got missed out. But what I did notice going through it all chronologically is that initially I only ever really wrote about the funny stuff. And as time went on, I allowed myself, maybe I realised what I was doing, that it was helping me, and I started to write more of the sad stuff.
Right.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Now, Harry Hill said that he delivered 14 babies. And I'm just wondering if I know that you're no longer licensed, but maybe you and Harry Hill could deliver some babies together, maybe on the Isle of Man, get to, sort of licensing for comic relief. I'm thinking might be good to get.
There's a lot.
Are there
of
any other famous doctor
huge,
comedians?
Huge numbers, probably because of what we've already talked about, the sort of interrelationship of medicine and humour as a coping mechanism, from Jonathan Miller to Graham Chapman to Graham Garden. Mike Wozniak, the actor, is one of my best mates from medical school. There's huge numbers. Simon Brodkin, who does the Lee Nelson character. There's as GPTA, there's a lot
is
of
he
it about.
A doctor, that Lee Nelson guy?
He is, Simon, yeah. He, again, not practising anymore, but yeah, absolutely.
Right,
went
wow.
to medical school in Manchester, I think it was, but yeah.
There's a lot of doctor comedians. So this could be this isn't just a one-off show, this could be a game show format that rolls on for weeks. I'm just interested in the hierarchy in hospitals, because you've given voice here to doctors, but I wonder if the real the people without a voice are the nurses.
Yeah.
Because I presume there's quite a lot of hierarchy even within an operating theatre.
There are all different healthcare professionals, and all of them are part of this jigsaw working far and beyond. There's 1.4 million people working in the NHS, and they're all pulling together to keep the rest of us alive. What doctors, nurses, physios, pharmacists, paramedics, occupational therapists, speech therapists, so many, more and more and more. I can only write my story, but there should be, you know, there is a place, I think, in the non-fiction market. I mean, there are some great stories by nurses. There was a book out earlier this year by Chrissy Watson called The Language of Kindness, about her nursing journey. She's now a full-time writer and lecturer in writing at one of the London universities, but was previously a nurse and has written very beautifully about that. I can't claim to have invented the genre of medical non-fiction. There's an extremely rich heritage of it, but I think what I've tried to focus on, which I'm not sure I'd read before, was the impact of the job on a human being at home and at work, rather than just the nuts and bolts of the job.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. I'm Bruce Daisley. You can sign up for the mailing list at eatsleepworkrepeat.fm, and that's a no-junk guarantee. It's just the latest insight and some fantastic free stuff. Thank you for listening. See you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.